The case I brought, though, is really the area where I find the greatest challenge, which is HER2-positive disease. My patient is in her early 30s, and she presented with a palpable breast mass that was about 4 centimeters on exam. She had a biopsy, and this is hormone receptor positive, HER2 3+ positive breast cancer with a clinically negative axilla. At the time that this was found, she was found to be about 12 weeks pregnant and came in for evaluation. These are visits that need to be done in a multidisciplinary fashion, not just with MedOnc and SurgeOnc, but we need to include maternal fetal medicine as well. In times past, there might have been a conversation about termination of a pregnancy to facilitate maternal cancer care, and that's often best led by maternal fetal medicine. But we have no data that terminating a pregnancy helps someone do better, and we do feel that we can successfully treat these breast cancers and successfully complete a healthy pregnancy. So we tend to lean away from these conversations encouraging termination. In situations like this, we tend to proceed with upfront surgery. This patient had a mastectomy, and at the time of surgery, her cancer was in the sort of T2 range, about 4 centimeters or so. She had lymphovascular invasion, but negative sentinel lymph node. So a patient where we'd want her to get HER2-directed therapy. We know that we can't give trastuzumab or pertuzumab in the setting of pregnancy, but we can safely give chemotherapy in the second and third trimester. So for this patient, we initiated upfront AC chemotherapy. She received 4 cycles every 3 weeks, so a 12-week course, and that took her to about 32 weeks gestation. Now, again, looking at our cohort, what we learned is in years past, there was a tendency for women with breast cancer and pregnancy to deliver prematurely, to deliver early. But when you really drill down on that, these women are not going into spontaneous preterm labor. They are being induced to help facilitate maternal cancer care. The problem is that coming out early is not good for the baby, and there's extensive literature in the pediatric world that late preterm delivery, so deliveries before 37 weeks gestation, have high morbidity for the infant. They have to go to the NICU, they have pulmonary complications, and so these are situations where we would want the patient to have a term pregnancy. So in these situations, I tend to initiate a patient on weekly paclitaxel, depending on how she's doing with the pregnancy, and then have a term delivery, and then I introduce the HER2-directed therapy after her delivery and complete the planned 12 weeks of treatment and continue on with endocrine therapy and radiation if necessary. And this has been the pattern that we've been proceeding with for many of our HER2-positive patients. But each situation is so unique, and each person is so unique, and so it really requires an individualized care plan for each patient.
So just to follow up a little bit on this, you know, you said that termination really doesn't necessarily improve the care. But one of the issues here is you are delaying a very crucial part of the care, which is anti-HER therapy for a period of months. Any thoughts about whether or not that does introduce any kind of risk to the patient?
Well, at this point in time, that technically is an unanswered question. And in our conversations with patients, we do discuss that there potentially could be an issue of compromise and that there could be an unmeasurable risk. However, we do know from the classic HERA data that providing the chemotherapy first and the HER2-directed therapy later did lead to the substantial benefits seen with HER2-directed therapy compared to those who did not receive it. And so in some ways, we are following almost a HERA-like approach, although we want to get that synergy of concurrent chemotherapy with HER2-directed therapy, and so that's why it's added as soon as the pregnancy is done. Certainly, we've had patients who are early in the pregnancy. The pregnancy may or may not be desired. Perhaps they want to or need to get preoperative therapy, and we have had people elect to terminate. But in contrast to years past, we do not encourage people to do it unless they feel like it's something that they want to do or if there was an exceptional circumstance.
You know, that HERA trial, that brings back, I think it was 2005 when the big adjuvant trials, but I forgot. Yeah, you're right. They had chemo first. So any estimates on the number of cases a year of pregnancy-associated breast cancer?
It's a good question. We don't have precise numbers. Breast cancer in pregnancy is one of the most common cancers we might see. The others are cervical and thyroid, which have, you know, very different care plans and prognoses. But we do know that the rate of breast cancer in pregnancy is increasing, likely related to societal patterns in delaying childbearing that we might see. So it is something that I think any oncologist who's seeing breast cancer patients will encounter from time to time. And we try to establish ourselves as having a center with specialty in this, because this way we can provide this multidisciplinary care, and also using our experiences create cohorts that will help support best practices for how to treat these patients. We also have great colleagues in Europe who have published data sets that also support trying to optimize systemic therapy for pregnant patients in order to achieve a prognosis that would be indistinguishable from a non-pregnant patient.
It's really awesome that you're doing this, and you know, it reminds me of other situations where there are not many patients, but you need really high-level expertise, T-cell lymphoma, you know, for example. Mm-hmm. But you know, here the need is so compelling when you think about it at a human level. So just to finish up here, I'm kind of starting to see a little bit of a story, a CME story, in a sense that, do I hear you saying that people are, you know, they have these patients, and they're kind of very nervous, the docs, and certainly the family and the patient. And maybe because of that anxiety, you know, these patients are being induced and delivered early. And as a consequence, you mentioned the fact that the child or the infant may experience problems, but also for a woman who's going through all these horrible, difficult problems, to have to then deal with an infant in the NICU is also really at a human level. It seems like a really compelling thing. Is it your impression that a lot of people are doing this, delivering early?
Well, when we look at both our data set and some of the other published data sets, we do see that prior practice patterns did include a fairly large number of early deliveries. Some of the publications have broken it down into spontaneous versus induced early deliveries. Some have not. But when we look at our data sets, we can clearly see that the trends have changed over time. And we work very hard to take our pregnancies to term. And I keep a little slideshow on my phone of all of these beautiful babies who come to visit me in clinic after they're delivered. And, you know, I have some who are in elementary school now. We haven't quite gotten to the point of following the children prospectively. But it is probably the best visit you can have as a medical oncologist, to see a patient who has just delivered a healthy baby, and she's thrilled and the baby's great, and you know, you've been doing your best to treat their breast cancer. So it's really gratifying.
Subsequent to these interviews, the primary results from the Phase 3 IMPASSION 130 trial were presented at the 2018 ESMO meeting and published in the New England Journal of Medicine, demonstrating that the addition of atezolizumab to nab-paclitaxel significantly improved progression-free survival when used in the first-line treatment of patients with advanced triple-negative breast cancer in both the intention-to-treat population and the PD-L1 positive subgroup. At this first interim survival analysis, a clinically meaningful improvement was also reported among patients with PD-L1 positive tumors, where the overall survival was increased by 10 months with a hazard rate of 0.62. The results from the Phase 3 Paloma 3 study were also presented at ESMO and published in the New England Journal, demonstrating that the addition of palbociclib to fulvestrant resulted in an improvement in overall survival in patients with hormone receptor-positive HER2-negative advanced breast cancer. In addition, also presented at ESMO were the results of the Phase 3 SOLAR-1 study evaluating the addition of alpelisib to fulvestrant for patients with hormone receptor-positive HER2-negative disease and one prior line of endocrine therapy. Progression-free survival was significantly prolonged with the addition of the PI3 kinase inhibitor alpelisib to fulvestrant, with a hazard rate of 0.65 in patients with PIK3CA tumor mutations. This is the first study to show statistically significant, clinically meaningful PFS improvement with an alpha-specific PI3 kinase inhibitor in this patient population. It's kind of interesting and maybe really an indication of the rapid pace at which new agents are being approved in oncology that when I returned to my desk after interviewing Dr. Mayer, I saw a press release on my computer stating that another PARP inhibitor, telazoparib, had received FDA approval for patients with germline BRCA mutations and HER2-negative, locally advanced or metastatic breast cancer. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.